Technology stocks were collapsing, and a new pessimism had found its way into the heart of the miracle economy. All Clark said was, "I'll be a billionaire again soon." And then he returned to the serious business of programming his boat and the search for the new thing. Chapter 14. Could Go Either Way. Clark said that Netscape made anarchy respectable. Late at night, when no one else was around, he must have wondered how long the odd sentiment could survive in corporate America. Institutions loathe disorder. They seek to socialize forces of anarchy. It's one of the many internal contradictions that have failed to collapse capitalism. Wealth generation is suppressed by those who are supposedly most interested in wealth. Rapid technological change threatens people who already have power, even when those people are technologists. This simple fact creates a certain internal tension in putatively high-technology corporations. While promoting change, big established companies also wish for change to occur slowly enough so that it does not overwhelm them. Netscape was so threatening to the established order because it suggested change could happen outside of that order, as fast as people like Jim Clark could make it happen, without regard to the establishment. Any number of events could conspire with the high-technology establishment to nudge the anarchic spirit off center stage and back to its usual, less reputable place in the wings. The stock market could collapse, for instance. Back in August 1995, when Netscape went public, the stock market had more or less said, "Okay, we know it is insane to encourage a company that has no profits, no clear idea of how it will make profits, and is in fact sort of making up its business as it goes along, but so long as we all agree to pretend that this is reasonable commercial behavior, we may create a miracle." When the Healthion public offering failed in October 1998, the stock market was saying, "Wait a minute, maybe this was all a big mistake." But the market was not quite the threat to Clark world that Microsoft was. About a year after Clark created Netscape, on June 21, 1995, the company's marketing director and Clark's old buddy from Silicon Graphics, Mike Homer, called Clark and told him that seven Microsoft executives, led by a man named Dan Rosen and acting on instructions from Bill Gates, had flown down to Silicon Valley and told Netscape that, unless Netscape gave Microsoft a seat on its board and sold Microsoft a piece of the business, Microsoft would put Netscape out of business. This was more of a promise than a threat. To run on the world's 500 million or so personal computers, Netscape's browser needed to be compatible with the latest release of Microsoft Windows, at that time Windows 95. Anyone who wished to write software for the personal computer obviously had to make sure that it was compatible with Windows. Netscape, like every other software company, needed Microsoft to release early versions of something called the APIs for Windows. API stood for Application Programming Interface, a typically incomprehensible piece of geek speak. An API was a kind of keyhole into Windows. To create keys that fit, Netscape needed to know the shapes of the holes. Microsoft's programmers routinely provided these to programmers who created software that didn't threaten Microsoft. They had been slower than usual to provide them to Netscape. On June 21, 1995, they told Netscape that unless Netscape caved into its demands, they would not provide them at all. As Microsoft executive Dan Rosen put it, according to notes kept during the meeting by Netscape's Mark Andreessen, "If we had a special relationship, you wouldn't be in this position." Later, Clark recalled what he thought the moment he put down the phone. "Fuck these assholes." A simple thought, easily acted upon. He immediately called Gary Reback, an attorney with the Silicon Valley law firm of Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich, and Rosati, told him what Homer had just said, and asked Reback to inform the U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ. 2 days later, Reback did just this, though he arranged for it to appear as if the Department of Justice had requested the information. Clark later told me that he'd taken this initiative because, "I didn't think Barksdale," Jim Barksdale, Netscape's new CEO, "was going to do anything about it." In any case, after Reback mailed his letter, the DOJ invited him in for an informal chat. At the time, the DOJ was toying with the idea of revisiting a settlement it had reached with Microsoft a few months before, in which Microsoft had agreed not to bundle new products with the operating system. Clark and Reback, together with several Netscape executives, flew to Washington. At his one and only meeting in Washington, D.C. with U.S. government lawyers, Clark first tried to explain what was about to happen in the computer business. The Justice Department had been concerned with Microsoft Network, an ill-conceived early attempt by Microsoft to contain the Internet in a single Microsoft-controlled space. Microsoft Network was a threat to no one, Clark argued, since it missed the whole point of the Internet, which was that it was uncontainable. The threat, he said, was Microsoft's inevitable entry into the new market for Internet browsers. Back in 1990, Clark had described his telecomputer as a kind of underbelly thing with Microsoft. If the digital revolution occurred on the television rather than the personal computer, he figured, there was at least a chance Microsoft would not control it. Netscape also was a kind of underbelly thing, but it lived much closer to the belly. To get onto the Internet, at least for the moment, you had to go through a personal computer, and the personal computer had single point of entry, the first window that popped up on the computer screen after a user had logged on. To get to any software inside the computer, the user had to pass through that window. As Microsoft controlled that window, it controlled everything on the other side of it, too. This sort of power was not unique to the computer industry. The railroad industry had some of the same monopolistic tendencies. But in the computer industry, the power was much harder for outsiders to discern, and thus to fight. The Internet challenged Microsoft's monopoly power in a roundabout way. The Internet did not have an operating system as such. Instead, it had several points of leverage from which the dominant company could nudge consumers this way or that. The first and seemingly most important was the browser, the software that enabled you to travel on the Internet. Computer users tended to follow the path of least technical resistance. Netscape's browser, which made it easy for people to travel around the Internet, was the first real window out of Windows. Windows became merely a starting point for a longer and more interesting trip. In the long run, the Internet would make it possible for users to reach out and collect all the software needed to run their computers. In the extreme case, it could render Microsoft's operating system superfluous. Of course, Microsoft held itself out as a friend of change and progress. Its founder, Bill Gates, the world's richest man, was forever publishing books and articles under his name, the sole purpose of which was to convey the idea that he was some kind of visionary. Gates's first book, published in the middle of 1995, had been called The Road Ahead. The Road Ahead came out a year and a half after Clark had said that the Internet is the future of all data communication, and all communications are data communications. And yet the author barely mentioned the Internet. The books and the magazine interviews and the advertising campaigns were a smokescreen. All Bill Gates wanted from the future was for it to look exactly like the present. To survive, Microsoft didn't need to discover the new thing, but tame it. That is why Clark knew, from the moment he created Netscape, that sooner or later, and probably sooner, Microsoft would seek to destroy him. Clark told the DOJ lawyers that Microsoft would use its monopoly to control the market for Internet browsers. For instance, Microsoft would be able to go to computer manufacturers such as Dell and Compaq and say, in effect, if you include on your machine Netscape's browser or exclude Microsoft's Internet Explorer, we'll put you out of business. And the DOJ's lawyers did not think that mattered. At least they didn't at first.
Jim had sort of seen the future, said Gary Reback. Manny kept saying to the justice people, that's not it. He'd seen the future before Bill Gates, and he was trying to explain it to the Justice Department. But the Justice Department insisted on fighting the previous battle.
It was almost instantly clear to Clark that any legal action would come too late to make any financial difference to him. An hour into the meeting, he began to fidget. An hour after that, he walked out and left the others behind to finish what he had started.
It was just clear to me that it was a waste of time, he said. At that point, I sort of gave up on the American legal system. When I caught up to him, recalled Gary Reback, Jim said, sorry, I just couldn't take it anymore, but you keep it up.
It was a full 2 years after Clark, through Reback, alerted the DOJ, before the DOJ formally announced it had come around to his way of thinking. One reason they came around was that Gary Reback had indeed kept it up. Reback peppered the government with news from the front lines of the browser war between Netscape and Microsoft. In March 1997, President Clinton appointed and the Senate confirmed Joel Klein as the department's new chief of antitrust enforcement. Truth was, no one expected Klein to enforce anything.
the senators who voted against his confirmation were Democrats who feared he'd lie down on the job. As Klein later explained how he came to a surprising October 1997 decision to sue Microsoft, "We got a white paper from Netscape and Gary Rebeck right around the time I took over, in the fall of 1996. I decided to put the investigators into Section 1 and Section 2 of the antitrust law, and to see if there were any violations of the consent decree, in which Microsoft had agreed not to bundle new products with new versions of Windows. We started to put resources behind the San Francisco office, and they started the process of collecting data." That data in turn led Klein and his chief economist, Dan Rubenfeld, to reconsider their former view of Microsoft as a benign force. In the summer of 1998, while Clark was arguing with the investment bankers about what Halcyon was worth and hunting down bugs in his boat software, the lawyers from Washington and New York passed through Silicon Valley to collect testimony. The lawyers for Microsoft questioned Clark. They were followed a few weeks later by the lawyers for the DOJ. Both groups videotaped Clark's testimony. Several times that summer, Clark turned up in the Seascape office wearing a suit. Whenever he put on a suit, he had the air of a man who had been invited to a costume party he did not wish to attend. On those days, he looked like every other American businessman. It was an odd sight, a man with hundreds of millions of dollars and an inclination to do whatever he wanted to do, up to and including turning entire industries on their heads, agreeing to live by someone else's dress code. Very deep inside him, Clark harbored the desire to be a good boy. The real rebels never exactly played the assigned role. To Clark, the upcoming Microsoft antitrust trial was moot. In the 3 years since he phoned Gary Rebeck, Netscape's share of the Internet browser market had fallen from 85% to 45%. Microsoft's share had risen from 0 to 50%. When people logged onto the Internet, their first impression was, increasingly, Microsoft's Internet Explorer. More importantly, the market expected Microsoft to win. Ergo, Microsoft would win. That simple fact gave Microsoft fantastic power over the Internet's future. Its software was regaining its purchase on the consumer. Once that happened, the goods and services Microsoft sold over the Internet would have a critical edge on the goods and services of others. "I can guarantee you what will happen next," Clark said often and loudly, usually apropos of nothing. "First, Microsoft will put us out of the browser business. The moment they have control of the browser business, they will cut out the links to other portals, Yahoo, X-Side, Lycos, etc. You'll have to go through Microsoft's portal. And once they've got control of the portal business, they'll get all the vertical markets. You don't think that's what they want to do? They're already doing travel. I guarantee you that Microsoft has the market power to take over every vertical market. Sooner or later, they'll get to healthcare." 3 months later, and a few days after Halcyon, seeking to control the largest vertical market, canceled its IPO, the greatest antitrust trial of the era opened. The American legal system, in effect, would decide how well a man should be rewarded who gropes for the new thing. By then, pretty much everyone, including Clark, had forgotten the phone call to Gary Rebeck that set the trial in motion. Certainly no one saw the Microsoft antitrust trial for what it was. Yet another rock Clark had pushed off the side of a cliff and watched with godlike detachment as it became an avalanche. An American court of law is in many ways un-American. In our everyday lives, we Americans celebrate the subversion of the social order. Everywhere a visitor to our country looks, he will find a poor American boy trying to make good, usually with the encouragement of his society. An American courtroom is designed first and foremost to preserve the social order, to keep the poor boy down. The judge sits on a raised dais from which he can condescend to the lawyers. The lawyers stand up so that they may condescend to the seated witness, and the witness, though he may have no one to whom he can plausibly condescend other than perhaps the curiosity seekers on the hard benches at the back of the room, at least has the comfort of his upholstered chair. If anyone dares to step the slightest bit out of line, a large man emerges from the back to shout, "Order in the court." If the judge decides he needs to relieve himself, the large man appears again to shout, "All rise." And everyone in the room stands and waits stupidly until the judge is ambled off to pee. There is not a please or a thank you or a by your leave in any of this. Our democracy system of justice is a feudal society in miniature. The United States District Court in Washington, D.C. had the charm and efficiency of a Soviet customs office. The ceiling of grime-streaked white tiles was lit by horrible fluorescent lights. The seal of the United States over the full moon face of Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson appeared to be made of the same hard plastic as a Halloween mask, for a number of reasons not worth going into, the main one being that the DOJ was not seeking monetary damages, there was no jury. The judge would render a verdict. Although it was one of the great antitrust trials since the antitrust laws were created back in 1890, the judge elected to hold it in a small courtroom. Most of the 450 reporters who turned up on the first day were left to rot in halls. The judge permitted each side to call just 12 witnesses. The DOJ's case now included companies other than Netscape, but Netscape was still the centerpiece. Microsoft stood accused by its government not merely of being a monopoly, in itself not illegal, but of abusing its monopoly powers to put Netscape and others out of business. Netscape offered the best documented example of Microsoft's abuse of power, thanks in large part to the early heads-up from Clark. As a result, the government wanted one strong witness from Netscape. "We thought about calling Jim Clark," one of the Justice Department lawyers told me during a recess. "And in many ways he might have been great because he was so knowledgeable about the technology. But the guy is a kind of maniac. He's not someone who you can discipline enough so you can say, 'Jim, here is what we want you to do.'" And so, in the end, the DOJ settled on Jim Barksdale, who, after all, had been hired by Clark and Dorr because he knew how to play his role. He put the same acceptably conventional face on Netscape's legal affairs as he did on its business affairs. The trial's opening arguments lasted just 2 days. The DOJ introduced endless emails and memos showing how Microsoft bribed and blackmailed companies into harming Netscape. "How much do we have to pay you to screw Netscape?" Gates asked executives of America Online in early 1996. On the third day, Microsoft called Barksdale to the stand. His job, from the point of view of the DOJ, was A, to lend further credence to the notes supplied from the June 21, 1995 meeting between Microsoft and Netscape, B, to explain how Microsoft had abused its monopoly to undermine Netscape, and C, to come across as a reasonable, trustworthy guy. This last assignment was maybe the most critical, as the judge, who hadn't the first clue about software, was forced to choose between conflicting accounts of the same events. It was made difficult by Microsoft's lead lawyer. This lawyer was a natural heavy, a great Hogarthian ball of pink flesh with jowls that rippled over his white starched shirt. The potted biography said his name was John Warden, and that he had grown up in Evansville, Indiana, graduated from the Harvard Law School, and had been for 12 years a partner at a fancy New York City corporate law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. Through it all, he'd somehow preserved an accent that would have made a hillbilly blush. He was proud of it, too. He'd lean into his microphone in the well of the United States District Courtroom and boom out his questions in the voice of God, causing the 50 spectators in the back of the room to jolt upright on their hard wooden pews. He was a hick, or pretending to be a hick, probably out of some old-fashioned belief that hicks, even make-believe hicks, are more appealing to juries than $1,500-an-hour New York lawyers, which is what he actually was. In any case, his voice had the dull, rolling groan of thunder from a bolt of lightning that has struck nothing far away. And it hadn't taken him long to prove that high technology sounded far less impressive when discussed by a fat hick. He went on about websites and Netscape and the Internet and modems. And with every syllable he made the whole of the modern condition sound a little bit ridiculous. When he mentioned AOL, it sounded like a yodel. AOL. The witness he addressed as Mr. Barksdale. Before he ever heard of Jim Clark or of Netscape or of this mess of a trial into which Clark, with the flick of his left wrist, had thrust him, Jim Barksdale had made a reputation for himself as a manager at Federal Express and McCaw Cellular. He'd grown up in Mississippi, and retained just enough of the piney woods patter to offer a passing imitation of a good old boy. All that was left of his linguistic origins was the just-below-upper-crust Southerner's habit of transforming soft consonants into hard ones. He said mature instead of mature. Clearly, he'd arrived at a point where he himself did not comprehend Hickspeak. When Warden thrust a document into his hand and asked him to read the first sentence of one of Gary Reback's memos aloud to the courtroom, Barksdale replied, "The first sentence?"
"Just read the sentence, Mr. Barksdale,"
the lawyer boomed back at him rudely. Everyone, with the possible exception of Barksdale, viewed the fat hick's rudeness as a ploy to get under Barksdale's skin. For nearly 5 full days, the two men argued violently about subjects neither fully understood. Neither had a software engineer's grasp of internet browser technology, but Barksdale was nothing if not shrewd. He soon figured out that he knew more than Warden, or for that matter, any of the lawyers, and used his superior understanding to embarrass his tormentors. Subtly, of course. For instance, Warden asked Barksdale if, before the critical meeting between Netscape and Microsoft on June 21, 1995, he knew that Microsoft intended to include all the functions of a browser in its operating system, thus implying that the meeting could hardly have been the shock Barksdale now claimed it was.
"A browser or the functions of a browser?" asked Barksdale cleverly.
This threw Warden, who stammered a bit. For 5 days he wore the expression of a C student who has been asked to explain to the whole class the difference between an algorithm and a logarithm. He was a triple agent in his own soul. A big-city lawyer who thought he had adopted strategically the surface mannerisms of a stupid hick, but who was, for the purposes of this trial, a stupid hick.
"A browser is a separate standalone product," said Barksdale, pressing his advantage. "It's a thing. It walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. It's a duck."
"It is?"
hollered Warden, recovering.
"Show me one. Where's the duck?"
"Right here,"
shouted Barksdale, pointing over the sleek dark wooden bar of the witness box to one of the United States District Court's computers, which looked nothing like a duck. End of discussion. Having proved nothing, Warden then proceeded to establish, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the people who worked for Netscape, had funny names. He proved his point by pronouncing them. A Netscape salesman named Ram Shriram, he called Ram Shram. He referred to Mitchell Baker, a Netscape lawyer, as Mr. Mitchell Baker.
"That's Mrs. Mitchell Baker," said Barksdale.
"Some of these names," said Warden, "you just can't tell. Could go either way."
By the time he was confronted with a Netscape employee named Alan Louie, the Microsoft lawyer knew better than to assume anything about these people from Northern California.
"It is Mr. Alan Louie?"
he boomed. Barksdale nodded.
"And I assume it is Louie?"
His tone said,
"These Netscape people got the girls with the boys' names and the boys with the girls' names. What the hell kind of enterprise you running, anyway?"
Soon came the time for the Microsoft lawyer to question the letter Jim Clark had told Gary Reback to write to the Justice Department, immediately after the critical meeting between Microsoft and Netscape on June 21, 1995. Brandishing the letter, Warden asked Barksdale to concede that it omitted any mention of Microsoft's alleged offer to divide the market for browsers. The idea was that if Microsoft had indeed made such a blatantly illegal suggestion, Netscape's lawyer would have at least mentioned it in his complaint to the DOJ.
"Mr. Barksdale," said Warden, "does the letter say anything about a proposal to divide markets?"
Barksdale replied that he hadn't read Reback's letter, which was now before him. Warden asked him to look it over.
"You want me to read this?"
asked Barksdale, incredulously, holding up the letter like a turd.
"Yes," said Warden.
Once earlier, Barksdale had waved his hand over some documents placed before him and declared,
"These things are totally useless."
Now he snorted, "A 4-page single-spaced letter?"
"I was able to read through it fairly quickly," said Warden plaintively. "Well, you're a much smarter man than I am," said Barksdale, his voice dripping with condescension.
The journalists in the bleacher seats exploded in laughter. Rich businessmen were honestly incapable of treating lawyers with anything but disdain.
"No,"
boomed Warden, in a desperate bid to recover whatever advantage there was in being the only fat hick in the room.
"You're a much smarter man, Mr. Barksdale. That's why you're worth $100 million.
and the bank owns my house.
At which point the judge peered down from the bench and said sharply,
Are you through, Mr. Warden?
He was. Barksdale wasn't. He'd been asked to recall the late stages of negotiations between Microsoft and Netscape, after Netscape had concluded that Microsoft never would divulge the critical code Netscape needed to make its browser compatible with Windows 95. He'd be damned if he wasn't going to recall it. He gazed out over the courtroom. It was, of course, filled with lawyers.
By now it had gotten down to the lawyers, Barksdale sighed, and when that happens you might as well forget about it.
Again the journalists exploded in laughter. There it was again, plain as day. Oh, the disdain! Oh, the contempt! And if the disdain could be expressed just like that to some of the most highly paid lawyers in the land, what did it say about all those other lawyers rowed up along the conference tables in the well of the courtroom, who spent all their day tapping keyboards and whispering secrets? What about all those bright young things who had sacrificed the best years of their lives to the Harvard Law School, and who now lived for the merest word of approval from the fat hick? Who did Jim Barksdale, serious American executive, think these whisperers of secrets and tappers of laptops were? Serfs. As the disorder in the court subsided, Barksdale smiled and leaned over to the judge, like a man about to tell a joke in a duck blind.
I mean that in an appropriate way, Your Honor.
His Honor blushed. What could he say? He was a lawyer, and this man was worth $100 million. The only man who could peer down upon Barksdale with the same Olympian disdain as Barksdale peered down upon lawyers wasn't present to do so. But he made a dramatic appearance. Clark didn't come in person. He spent the early days of the Microsoft trial rushing to ready his boat to cross the Atlantic Ocean. But his image appeared on the giant screen in the courtroom, and he answered a few questions in a tone that suggested that people who worked as lawyers for Microsoft could not begin to understand the new thing.
You obviously aren't a businessman, he said sarcastically at one point.
The law changes everything it touches, however, and it now did so in a way for which Clark was ill-prepared, by probing his past. The American legal system opened up the cardboard boxes beside the old tuba in Clark's guest bedroom and went digging for damning evidence. Up till then, Microsoft's defense was not much more than a gloriously indiscriminate flailing attack on Netscape. It consisted of four arguments. 1. Microsoft never bullied Netscape, especially in the critical June 21, 1995 meeting between the two companies that had inspired Jim Clark to call the Department of Justice in the first place. 2. Even if Microsoft did bully Netscape in that meeting, the meeting was a setup to frame Microsoft for an antitrust suit. 3. Microsoft could not possibly be held responsible for Netscape's failure because Netscape hadn't failed. It was still a market leader and a powerful innovator in Internet browser technology. 4. Netscape had failed badly, but through its own ineptitude. As evidence of this last point, Microsoft's lawyer introduced a new book by two Harvard Business School professors called Competing on Internet Time. The professors argued that Netscape courted disaster from the start by taunting Microsoft. Mooning the giant was what the business school professors had called this tactic. Clark had mooned the giant, first by referring to Microsoft in public as the Death Star, and then by permitting his 22-year-old associate, Mark Andreessen, to brag to journalists that Netscape would put Microsoft out of business. Barksdale adopted a self-deprecating tone. Whenever the Microsoft lawyer set out to argue how successful Netscape remained, Jim Barksdale tried to maintain pretty much the opposite. And so the spectators witnessed the odd spectacle of two companies, both keenly aware that they were in a line of work where the perception of success led to success, and the perception of failure to failure, bad-mouthing themselves. The rhetoric of the courtroom was very nearly the opposite of the rhetoric of the business world. The trick for Microsoft was to persuade the judge that it didn't have a monopoly without also persuading the stock market. The trick for Netscape was to avoid seeming pathetic. And then Jim Clark entered the courtroom. A man who cared more about his past would have covered his tracks. Some part of his mind would have been devoted to viewing his actions as they would be viewed by history, but that wasn't the way he was built. Clark was inventing his life as he went along, Pushing forward in this manner, he left a mess behind him for others to clean up. The mess was often inspired, but it was still a mess. And out of the mess, the lawyers for Microsoft plucked a single email. It had been sent by Clark to Microsoft executives Dan Rosen and Brad Silverberg on December 29, 1994, at 3 in the morning.
"I'd like to convince you to reconsider," it began.
It ran on for a full page, but the gist of it could be boiled down to a single passage.
"We want to make this company a success, but not at Microsoft's expense. We'd like to work with you. Working together could be in your self-interest as well as ours. Depending on your interest level, you might take an equity position in Netscape with the ability to expand that position later."
Given the worry that exists regarding Microsoft's dominance of practically everything, we might be a good indirect way to get into the Internet business.
He concluded, "No one in my organization knows about this message." Projected onto the big screen, Clark's email had different effects on different people. Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson wore what was becoming his usual expression of profound bemusement. An email sent at 3 a.m. was just further evidence that these technology billionaires were a bit touched. The judge had his own idea of work, which was that it has ended punctually at 5 p.m. You wouldn't be catching him hunched over any little rectangular screen at 3 a.m. trying to figure out how to make $1 billion. His court was in session for 2 hours and 15 minutes each morning, and the same each afternoon. 4.5 hours a day, 4 days a week. Fridays were holidays. So are lots of other days, chosen seemingly at random by the judge. The very idea of someone writing an email at 3 a.m. on December 29th, which was, after all, still Christmas vacation, struck him as preposterous. The lawyers for the Department of Justice were glum. They were doing their best to persuade the judge that Microsoft had muscled Netscape around. If Clark had invited Microsoft into his business back in December 1994, how could the DOJ now claim that Microsoft had forced its charms upon Netscape in June 1995? The DOJ's lawyers were still angry at Clark. He hadn't told them about his overture to Microsoft. The department's lawyers had learned about it only when the email was produced by Microsoft in pre-trial evidence. Finally, there was Barksdale's reaction to Clark's astonishing email, which amounted to an offer to serve as a kind of Trojan horse for Microsoft's invasion of the Internet. Clark had talked Barksdale into leaving his job with AT&T. Barksdale had agreed to run Netscape on the condition that he have complete control. Clark and John Doerr had both agreed not to meddle. And now this. Clark's email inviting Microsoft to sit in on his business was written 5 days before Barksdale reported for work. And the only reason Barksdale knew about it now was that the Department of Justice lawyers had warned him it was coming, before he took the stand. Forewarned, Barksdale sought to maintain that Clark's email had been written in a moment of weakness. The Microsoft lawyer, of course, hoped to persuade the judge that the email was not the act of a man fighting his demons at 3 a.m, but a deliberate corporate policy. He wanted to force Barksdale to concede that he and Clark were part of a unified team, and therefore Barksdale must have known of the email. Once he had Barksdale under oath, he offered him a terrible choice. Barksdale could agree that he, like Jim Clark, had been happy to invite Microsoft into Netscape's business and thus torpedo the government's entire case, or he could seem like a fool who was not privy to the intimate affairs of his own company.
"Mr. Barksdale," the Microsoft lawyer boomed.
Barksdale looked up.
"Is Mr. Clark a highly secretive man?" asked the lawyer.
"He can be very secretive, yes, sir," replied Barksdale.
"Mr. Clark has had a very successful business career, has he not?" asked the lawyer.
"Yes, he has," replied Barksdale.
"And does he enjoy a public reputation for veracity?" asked the lawyer.
"I couldn't comment on that," replied Barksdale. "I don't know."
"Do you regard him as a truthful man?"
It took him so long to ask the question that a swarm of mosquitoes could have hatched in his mouth. Even so, Barksdale needed time to think. Had it been a movie instead of real life, he would have flashed back to the previous 3 years. Right from the moment he left the secure womb of serious American business and entered Clark World, Barksdale's life had become a constant struggle to preserve his dignity.
At dinner parties, Barksdale told a funny story about his first trip down to Silicon Valley, when he and his wife met up with a realtor Clark had put him onto, with the assurance that she was the best in the business. Clark's real estate agent turned out to be one of those loud, garrulous people who, as she drives, insists on making eye contact with the passengers in the back seat.
"You want to see Scott Cook's house?"
she hollered over her shoulder to a terrified Mr. and Mrs. Jim Barksdale. Scott Cook was the chairman of Intuit, the financial software company.
"Is it for sale?" asked Barksdale.
"No,"
said the woman.
"Then I don't want to see it," said Barksdale.
Clark's realtor ignored him and squealed through this enormous bronze gate and into Scott Cook's driveway. Out of the house shot Mrs. Scott Cook to investigate this intrusion. Clark's realtor had panicked, backed up, and tried to make a quick getaway, but ended up rolling back into Mrs. Scott Cook's newly planted garden. There she became stuck in the mud. Wheels spun, plants flew. Mrs. Scott Cook was livid. She looked at Barksdale as if he were some kind of criminal. They had to call a fire truck and a tow truck to extract him, his wife, and Clark's realtor from the garden. The episode lasted an hour. At the time, it appeared to be a freak incident. In retrospect, it was the keynote for Barksdale's career in Clark World. Clark had treated him as gently as Clark was capable of treating any captain, but that was still more roughly than Barksdale had ever been treated. The IPO had been an excellent case in point. Barksdale had wanted for Netscape to remain a private company. He liked the old-fashioned method of waiting until a company was profitable before taking on public shareholders. But just a few months after Barksdale joined the company, Clark showed up for a board meeting with Frank Quattrone and Larry Sonsini in tow. Quattrone and Sonsini were respectively the leading investment banker and lawyer in Silicon Valley. During the meeting, Clark, who was of course eager to get the money to pay for his boat, turned to them and asked what they thought about taking Netscape public. Lawyers and investment bankers make their fortunes when companies go public. Both men joined Clark in pushing Barksdale to do the deed, all so that Jim Clark could pay for his boat. You might have thought Clark would have been well satisfied to get his money. You might have thought he'd move on. Not a bit. Clark was forever hounding Barksdale to follow Yahoo and Excite into the portal business. Portals, like Browser, were another coinage of the Internet. On the heels of Netscape, several people at once had the bright idea of creating a sort of doorway or portal into the new virtual world. The browser enabled the user to travel around the Internet, but how would he know where to go? The information on the Internet cried out to be organized, and the portal companies responded to the cry. Clark kept telling Barksdale that the future was not in selling browsers, but in attracting the masses to Netscape's own rather lackluster portal. Worse, he was right. On technical matters, Barksdale was at the mercy of Mark Andreessen, the young man who had first shown Clark an Internet browser, and helped him to create Netscape. Andreessen had stayed on as Netscape's technical authority, but he had threatened to quit half a dozen times, and threatened to sell all his Netscape shares more often than that. Imagine what the financial press would have done with that. As it was, Andreessen had unloaded a quarter of his stake near the low at $16 a share. Jim Barksdale, serious American executive, was no longer a leader of men. He was a babysitter. On top of it all, there was this trial. It might as well have been Clark's doing. Once it became inevitable that Netscape would be the centerpiece of the DOJ's complaint against Microsoft, Barksdale took charge of the matter, of course. That was his job, to lend order and reason to other people's anarchies. But the whole reason Clark had called Gary Reback and had him write the letter to the Justice Department was because he feared that Barksdale would never have done anything, and he was probably right. As Barksdale sat unhappily in the witness box, he considered the question. Did he regard Jim Clark as a truthful man? Already he had sworn that he had never seen Clark's email. This might be strictly true. After all, Barksdale hadn't figured out how to read his own email, but his profession of ignorance did not begin to capture the spirit of that moment. The DOJ had shown Netscape's counsel Roberta Katz a copy of Clark's email, and Roberta Katz had helped Barksdale prepare for his cross-examination. They both knew that he would be shown Clark's email and asked to explain it. Barksdale's show of ignorance was for effect. If he didn't know about it, then it must not be terribly important. But the truth was, he was shocked. He'd been hired to confer a certain dignity on Clark's new enterprise, and the email stripped him of that.
The email made him seem like the hired help who had been told only as much as he needed to know.
"Do you regard Jim Clark as a truthful man?" the lawyer had asked.
"I regard him as a salesman," replied Barksdale.
"I'm not going to touch that, Mr. Barksdale," said the Microsoft lawyer, and moved on to less interesting matters.
Chapter 15. At Sea in the Home of the Future. To spend any time at all with Clark, you had to forswear the usual conveniences that come with planning ahead. Advance purchase airline tickets, hotel reservations, clean underwear. Clark's friends learned to take it in stride when the call came from Jim, always from a cell phone, usually 1,000 miles or so from where they expected him to be at that moment, that began,
"Hey, I just wanted to let you know that, there's been a change of plans. I won't be meeting you in Nairobi this afternoon."
Clark's wife, Nancy Rutter, had long ago figured out that any plans he made were not plans at all. A plan was merely a theory of how he might spend his day. At all times, it clashed in his mind with 6 other theories. It came as no surprise to anyone who knew Clark, and it certainly did not surprise his new crew, that before he crossed the Atlantic Ocean on his new computerized yacht, he first had to change his mind 7 or 8 times about whether to do it. First, he said that he would not miss the crossing for the world. Then he said that he might have to miss it to give a speech to some students at Stanford University. Then he saw that he could cancel the speech to make the crossing, and became more excited than ever about sailing across the ocean. Once he set the date of departure, he said that the boat could not leave because on that day the curtains in the boat's living room were not exactly the way he wanted them to be. On and on he went. He was a man with a daisy playing "She Loves Me, She Loves Me Not," except that he was doing it with his entire life. Finally, at 4 o'clock one morning in January 1999, or 3 months after Healthian canceled its IPO, we boarded Clark's plane in Palm Beach, Florida, and flew to the Canary Islands. Me, Clark, and Hyperion chef Tina Braddock, whom Clark had decided to take with him wherever he went. The rest of its crew and software engineer Steve Haig were already on board. Lance and Tim had been sent back to the room on top of the Jenny Craig Weight Loss Center in Menlo Park, California. Hyperion had just passed Spain on its way to a dock in Grand Canary, where it planned to collect us the next day. Clark's jet was fired up and ready to go. His luggage compartment was crammed with food and wine for the crossing. After 7 years of writing software that could sail a boat, Clark at last had the chance to watch his program guide his boat across an ocean. Even so, no one on his jet could predict what would happen next. When Clark went off to fiddle with something in the back of his plane, Tina leaned across the aisle and said nervously, "I wonder if we're really going to go." She knew. Somewhere was a reason for not sailing across the Atlantic Ocean on Hyperion's maiden voyage. She also knew that she would have to wait to find out what that might be. By the time we arrived on Grand Canary, the crowd of islanders already had gathered. It was an ugly dock in an industrial area, 6 miles from any place a sane human being would voluntarily venture. Yet all that night the people came and gawked. At midnight, islanders streamed down the dock on foot or puttered out in shambolic old cars, stopped and peered into the boat. By midnight there was not much to see, a few people milling around, Steve and Jim down below plinking commands into their computers, and Alan Pryor perched in his captain's chair, wearing the same outfit he'd worn the past 3 days, staring, for reasons that would soon become clear, into the computer screen. A few hours after we arrived, Alan took his position at the helm, behind the row of computer screens, punched a few buttons, and sailed Hyperion into the Atlantic Ocean. As we pushed away from the Canary Island dock and headed out to sea, the crew and the passengers gathered around the captain and took one long last look. From the guest cabins came Steve and Clark and Louis Sahoyas, the photographer Clark had hired to document the crossing. From the kitchen came Tina and her steward Peter, and his assistant Christy. From the deck came First Mate Jamie and the 2 deckhands, Simon Hutchins and the curiously named Cecilia. The sun beamed and the sea stretched out calmly as if the Atlantic were inviting us to cross. Just when it seemed that everyone was present and basking in the pride of departure, the kitchen floor opened up and a man climbed out of a hole. He looked as if he had not seen sunlight for a century. He was the engineer,
Robert.
That is how 11 of the 12 people on board began crossing the Atlantic Ocean, with a sense of adventure. For most people who do it, there is some romance in sailing across the Atlantic Ocean. Columbus, no less, had left from the Canary Islands and sailed for 3 months to the Caribbean. We would follow Columbus's wake, though we'd need only 10 days to make the same trip. Imagine. The rest of us did. Only Clark didn't, or wouldn't, or couldn't imagine. He was not one of those people who can be sustained for long by other people's fictions. He required his own. He saw the romance in the journey, or at any rate he saw that there should be romance in it. Certainly the idea of it appealed to him. If it hadn't, he wouldn't have hired a photographer to come along to document it. But it soon became clear why he'd been so reluctant to come. The reality of the thing would nearly kill him. The reality of crossing the Atlantic on a sailboat is that it is tedious. Very, very tedious. At least when it goes well, it is tedious. When it goes badly, it is treacherous. Not long after we departed, Robert the engineer gave me and Louis, who, it was clear to all, had to be watched like a couple of morons, a tour of the stuff that was used only when things went wrong. The life rafts, the fancy life jackets with special whistles and flares, the man overboard system, the fire alarms. Robert tapped the side of the canister of gas hanging from a wall and used, apparently, to put out fires.
"The chances that you'll be firing the gases is very remote," he said. "But if everyone else on board is dead, you know, have a go."
So far as I could tell, there were several ways to die while crossing an ocean on a sailboat. If there weren't, it wouldn't be an adventure. One was to be run over by a tanker so large that it does not even realize it has hit you. The second was to be swept up in a storm that caused the mast to snap or the boat to capsize. A third was to fall overboard. The fourth, and most likely, was to die of boredom. Clark was concerned only with the fourth. For him, the crossing was a study in absences. No change, no diversion, no stimulation, no new place to go. He seemed to know at the outset that there are only so many times you can find Orion's Belt, or scan the horizon for whales and porpoises that fail to materialize, or remind yourself that an ocean crossing is meant to be the thrill of a lifetime before you begin to doubt the whole enterprise. The average man would require perhaps 3 days to discover his inner mutineer. It took Clark a bit under 3 hours. Exactly 2 hours and 40 minutes into the 10-day trip, he turned to me and said,
"I don't know why the fuck I came on this. It's going to be boring as hell."
He then walked over to Alan, who struck the pose of the captain at the helm, and gave an order to relay to the computers, which amounted to,
"Get across this ocean in a straight line as fast as you possibly can."
Then he went down below into the living room and moped. On a boat, the living room is for some reason called the salon. Clark sunk into one of the deep upholstered chairs in his salon and surveyed his creation. A Monet landscape hung on the wall over his head, and a Picasso portrait from his blue period hung on the wall 8 feet across from him. When he set out to make enough money to build his boat, he'd overshot a bit. Here was the moment in the Hollywood movie where the script would direct him to wave his hand over his brand-new $37 million boat, decorated with another $30 million in paintings, and say what an amazing thing it was that a poor boy from Plainview, Texas, could sail off into the sunset in such a machine, bought and paid for with money he'd made inside of 18 months. Instead, his mouth squinched up into its terrifying pucker of irritation. You could see that his mind had got hold of some object it disapproved of and was working itself into a tizzy. Finally, he said,
"They should have extended the woodwork around the portholes."
The crew looked up to see what was wrong with the portholes. They were rimmed by white-painted aluminum rather than the dark teak and mahogany of the rest of the interior. They seemed fine to me, more than fine, and obviously they had seemed fine to the 50 or so Dutch master woodworkers who had created the interior. But here we were, at sea at last, and all Clark could think about was how they might have been better. The man chose his own path to madness, and it was not the path of the pessimist, but of the utopian. He was on an endless search for some unattainable solution, the perfect world. The moment he suspected that he had created that perfect world, however, he found something in it that needed to be changed. For the other 11 people on board, the trip began calmly enough. Those who had business went about it. Cecilia and Jamie and Simon swabbed the decks and tested the sails. Steve hunched over his computer for hours on end until his posture called to mind Ichabod Crane with a backache. Clark, once he became tired of finding things that were wrong with his new boat, vanished into his cabin to find things that were wrong with his computer code. For the first few days he appeared only to eat, to drink, or to consult with Steve about some intractable bug. The seas were neither calm nor rough. There were no tankers or, for that matter, ships of any sort on the horizon. The only voice on the radio was static, punctuated by the occasional squawking from Filipino deckhands on the supertankers we could not see.
"Filipino monkey! Filipino monkey!"
They'd holler hysterically at each other for some reason no one could explain. Then they burst into mad howls. They sounded like people who rammed sailboats for kicks. For the first few days, we lived in a changeless world. Our biggest challenge, at least at the outset, was to avoid getting on each other's nerves. The challenge was heightened by a strangely powerful form of sleep deprivation known as the watch. Other than Clark, everyone on board was required to sit 2 4-hour watches to ensure that we were not plowed under by the Filipino monkeys. Alan Pryor posted the watch schedule just before we left. It looked like this. 12 to 4, Jamie, Cecilia, Peter. 4 to 8, Robert, Simon, Louis, Michael. 8 to 12, Alan, Christy, Steve. The person listed first on each shift was officially designated captain of the watch. Our watch had 4 people on it because it included the 2 people, me and Louis the photographer, who had no business on the boat. The captain had assumed that 2 idiots added up to 1 useful person. Actually, they didn't even add up to that, as we discovered one evening when Robert was below inspecting the engine room. Struck by an intensely painful bowel movement, Simon hopped around the deck on 1 foot for 20 minutes straight, rather than entrust me and Louis with the job of spotting supertankers before they crushed us. The watch schedule repeated itself each 12 hours. In the grand scheme of human suffering, a 4-hour watch does not sound like much. Until you have gazed into perfect unchanging blankness for 4 hours straight, you might even think it soothing. Coupled with the churning of the sea and the creaking of the boat, it was deadly. The sea transformed the boat's beds into souped-up, turbocharged versions of the coin-operated vibrating beds in a 1970 Holiday Inn. The new Dutch woodwork crackled like strings of miniature firecrackers. All in all, bedtime on Hyperion was more an idea than a fact. This was true not merely for the landlubbers, but for everyone on board. Before long, eyes were rheumy, nerves frayed, and the feelings that are normally well sealed inside people's hearts began to leak, then gush, out. For the first few days, Captain Alan Pryor either sat at the wheel or hovered covetously over the computer, with an intensity that surprised me, given how often he disavowed any interest in the thing. Once every half hour or so, something minor went wrong, or the computer believed it went wrong, and an alarm sounded. Beep, beep, beep it went, as Clark had not yet had time to write the code that enabled the computer to shout at the crew. Whenever the alarm made its irritating noise, another crew member shouted out, "Robert, alarm!" And Robert, the stout young engineer, would pop out through some hatch in the floor, wander over, punch a button or two on the computer, and the annoying beep, beep, beep ceased. On the surface, at least, all seemed well. All was not well, though apart from Clark's obvious discontent, the signs of this were subtle. On the first night, Louis's cabin overheated all by itself. Louis emerged for our 4 a.m. watch with trickles of sweat running down the sides of his face. He asked quite reasonably, "Why is it so fucking hot in my cabin?" It turned out that it was hot because the computer decided it should be hot. It took about 2 hours of punching buttons on the computers to persuade it to lower the temperature, only to have the computer decide, seemingly by edict, to raise it again. On the second night, as Steve slept in the cabin he and I shared, someone mistakenly activated the flat panel display screen tucked inside the ceiling. Our cabin, for some reason I never understood, had one computer screen in a drawer by the bed and another hidden up in the ceiling. At 2 in the morning, the ceiling over Steve's head opened with an eerie hum, and a green glowing screen dropped down from a new hole like a UFO. It had scared the hell out of him, as it would anyone. Obviously, these were mere ripples in the pond. Changes in technology are not simple matters. Often they change the way people interact with their surroundings and with each other. Invent the automobile and people will travel more often. Invent air conditioning and they'll travel south. Hyperion offered a neat little illustration of the early stages of technically inspired social chaos. There is, or was, until Jim Clark got a hold of it, probably no space in the Western world outside of a church more highly ritualized than a sailboat. It has its own peculiar vocabulary designed to mystify outsiders. Lee, jib, splice, tang, furl, gimbal. Not one in ten intelligent landlubbers could define half of them. There are customs and traditions on a sailboat. There is a carefully observed pecking order. The captain lords it over the first mate. The first mate lords it over the deckhands. The deckhands lord it over the stewards. Into this neat little feudal environment, Clark had thrust his anarchic temperament and his 21 Silicon Graphics computers. More computing power than you'd find in a big, fully automated factory. The crew who did not understand computers suddenly discovered they were at the mercy of those who did. This posed some obvious threats to the peace. As I say, the early signs that the technologists' utopia was anything but were subtle. On our watch, for instance, Simon and Robert preferred not to sit together. When Robert entered a conversation, Simon left it. Either I sat with Simon on the deck and Louis sat with Robert on the bridge, or more often, I sat with Robert on the bridge and Louis sat with Simon on the deck. The two crew members were clearly avoiding each other without making that big a deal of it. On the third evening, Robert and I sat together in the tall swivel chairs on the bridge, facing the bank of five glowing flat-panel display screens. Outside, the sea washed gently against the hull, and the stars twinkled. Robert began to talk about what it meant to be an engineer. When he used the word engineer, he clearly meant old-fashioned engineer and not computer geek. He held the view that there were two kinds of people in the world, those who did the work and those who got the credit. Real engineers belonged in the former category. Among other things, he felt that engineers had been generally neglected by history.
"Who invented the gas turbine engine?" he asked a bit sharply.
I had no idea.
"Frank Whittle," he said. "Who was the chief engineer on the Apollo project?"
I said I didn't know the answer to that one either.
"Exactly," said Robert, and rested his case.
In the darkness I could hear him smiling.
"But if you want to get your picture in the paper now," he said, "all you have to do is sit in front of a computer screen."
He whistled a bit to himself, then said,
"When something goes wrong with this boat, everyone assumes the engineer broke it. When the computer program goes wrong, everyone assumes the geeks fix it. Why do you think that is?"
The room was dark except for the glowing orange screens. The waves rocked the boat back and forth. Robert was no more than a thick shadow.
"The problem here," that voice now said, "is that Jim has built the most technologically sophisticated boat ever built, and staffed it with non-technical people."
This statement made no immediate sense at all to me. After all, Simon had been hired by Clark to present the computers to the crew with the human face. Simon could not program a computer, but he had learned from a 3-week stint at Silicon Graphics how to perform some rudimentary technical tasks. If your laptop crashed, Simon was distinctly more likely than you were to solve the problem. He belonged to the growing tribe of semi-technical people whose main function is to respond to mankind's complaints about its computers. Undoubtedly, he was the first deckhand in history who, to become a deckhand, needed to know some computer science. I said as much to Robert.
"If something goes really wrong, Simon can't fix it," said Robert. "That's one of the reasons there's friction between me and Simon. I told Alan that I thought the person on board who was to be the computer interface should have 15 years' training in the area. Alan doesn't have any idea how it all works, and neither does Simon. Simon cannot program the computer. These aren't technical people, and you want things to work when you press the button on the computer."
Apparently Robert had already become slightly fed up by things not working when he pressed a button on the computer. He was, after all, a technical man. There were times, he said, when he couldn't figure out how to turn out the lights, and it bothered him. Late on the fourth day at sea, we turned south and switched on the engine. South was the wrong direction for anyone making a beeline for the New World. Just a few hours earlier, Clark had said he was in a hurry to get back home, as he really needed to give this speech to 2,000 doctors who might become customers of Healthion. But now he'd changed his mind about the urgency of arriving on time. He said he wanted to get out of the cold. As a weak wind blew from the wrong direction, the computer reeled the mainsail back into the boom and revved the engine to a brisk 12 knots. For the moment, we would forget the joy of sailing and rely on the engine to get us across. Clark retired to his cabin at 10 o'clock, and I went to the guest cabin soon afterwards. At midnight, Steve's watch ended, and he came into the cabin and fell into the other bed. He reflected briefly on his curious role, the man who wrote the code that controlled the sailboat. The boat was not meant to be carrying a programmer, but now a programmer was indispensable. Back at the boatyard, we really didn't have a chance to test the system because we never had the full system up and running, he said. I needed to be around just to understand the computers, because no one else does except Jim, and Jim doesn't want to fuck with explaining it all to Simon. I still wonder how this boat will function without either me or Lance or Tim or Jim on board. If there's a serious failure, I guess they'll just reboot the computers and hope for the best. I asked the obvious question, how Hyperion had come to pass. I'm not sure how much Jim knew about sailing, to be honest, he said. He just had this idea he wanted to sail a boat by remote control. He sailed a lot before he left Silicon Graphics, I said, because he had. Maybe, said Steve, but this thing kind of started as a lab experiment. Then he said again what he had said once before so disconcertingly. I don't think Jim understood that people's lives depended on this stuff working properly. Then he fell into a deep sleep. The boat whirred and clicked and rose and fell. The new wood creaking into place sounded like a tall tree just before it snaps. Other than that, I realized, every noise on board was the result of the computer doing something. I stared at the ceiling and envied Steve his snore. Half an hour later, just before 1 a.m, the engine stopped. The whirring and clicking stopped with it. The boat went quiet. When the engine quit for the first time, I was rolling around in bed, attempting to calculate the size of the waves from the violence with which I was thrown back against the wall and forth into the safety board that had been installed to prevent me from being hurled out of the bed altogether. Even I could tell that something had gone wrong. One moment there was the low whir and the feel of a machine cutting purposefully through the waters. The next moment the boat was adrift. The waves rocked the bed more violently than before and in new directions. Up top I went. The watch from midnight to 4 a.m. was manned by Jamie, the Australian first mate, Peter, the American steward, and Cecilia, the Swedish deckhand. Normally they'd be wandering about, checking up on things. When I arrived, all three were in the control room pushing buttons on the computer screens. They were clearly perplexed. A small red light marked alarm flashed on the computer, which emitted its annoying high-pitched beep. Luckily, the next person to arrive was Robert.
I couldn't sleep, he said, popping his head through the hatch. What's happened?
The engine just stopped, said Jamie.
Well, that's unfortunate, said Robert, and moved to the screen and switched off the alarms.
The beeping sound ceased. In its place appeared the man who invented the idea of the beeping sound.
What's going on?
Said Clark, climbing up the stairs from the main salon to the control room.
It sounded like the engine stopped.
He moved into a position immediately in front of the bank of display screens. He punched in the password that enabled him to enter.